Welcome to episode 21 of the Infection Sim. Once again, we dip our toes into politics rather than science, but it's still all about who's benefiting from controlling information and preventing certain discussions from happening. If you want to comment on any episode of The Infectious Myth, please email me at david.crow, that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com, or check out our new Facebook page, facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or on Twitter at infectiousmyth, using the hashtag TIM. If you want to help spread the word about this show, please do that. Let your friends know on Facebook, Twitter, or the old-fashioned way by talking to them. Anyway, today I'm very pleased to have with me Lance DeHaven Smith, a professor at Florida State University in Tallahassee, author of, among other things, Conspiracy Theory in America, a journal article entitled Conspiracy Theory Reconsidered, Responding to Mass Suspicions of Political Criminality in High Office. And he first came to attention to my attention because he coined the term SCAD, State Crimes Against Democracy. So, Lance, are you with us?
Yes, I am, David.
I hope you don't mind me calling you Lance. Your first name is a lot less cumbersome than your second.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. It seems to me that the term conspiracy theory, and I think you agree with me, is used as a put-down. Like, all you need to say to somebody is, oh, that's just a conspiracy theory, and that kind of ends the discussion. Yet, the straightforward definition of conspiracy is an agreement between two or more persons to engage jointly in an unlawful or criminal act, or an act that is innocent in itself but becomes unlawful when done by a combination of actors. But doesn't that cover a lot of things that are done on a daily basis, including government actions?
Yes, if they're conspiring to do, to commit a crime of some sort. Conspiracy is a well-established legal concept.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually used in the Nuremberg war crimes trials after World War II.
Right.
The charges in the trials were the first charge in the indictment was that the Nazis had conspired to essentially frighten the public and stampede the German public into an authoritarian state. The Nazis were not elected democratically. They never got a majority of parliament, but they did some false flag operations and frightened the public and then outlawed the Communist Party, so they got a majority.
Right, so they were able to... So there was a conspiracy to allow them to take over the government by a number of steps, including... like you say, sowing fear amongst people. I mean, isn't that similar to what happened with the weapons, with the war in Iraq, the weapons of mass destruction?
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. We know from the Downing Street memos that the British government chronicled the meetings between President Bush and Tony Blair, and they said that there were not weapons of mass destruction, but... The president said, well, we were going, his words were, fix the facts to the policy. In other words, the policy was invasion of Iraq, and they were going to gin up some facts to support that. So, I mean, that's a high crime. It's treason, basically.
And that is a conspiracy, because all you need for conspiracy is two people plotting to do something illegal, right?
Correct. And they
were a lot more than two people involved in that particular episode.
Well, and, just to get technical, it was a treaty, in effect, an agreement between two countries that was never brought before the Senate for consent and approval. And, I mean, the problem we've got in the United States, in part, is because of the conspiracy theory term and how it puts down everything, and we're socialized to think that any suspicion of elite political criminality is just a crazy idea. A conspiracy theory is just a crazy idea. As a result of that, we don't look at it as a crime. We don't think in criminological terms. And the what what Bush had done was, you know, enter a treaty, not get approval from the Senate, make an agreement to invade Iraq with the British. He committed murder. I mean, that's Vincent Bugliosi, who's a well-regarded prosecutor in the United States, said that Bush committed murder and should be tried for murder because he brought the deaths of many American soldiers about through his deception, his fraud.
Right. I think the next person I'm going to interview is a man named John Turman, who wrote a book trying to count the dead in America's wars, including the war in Iraq, because
right.
there's no attention paid to the deaths of civilians, and yet
right.
there could be up to a million people killed in Iraq, and very few of those people would have died if the war hadn't happened.
Well, and understand too that we are a party to the United Nations Charter. That charter is a treaty, and our Constitution says that treaties are the highest law of the land. And what that treaty says, the charter, is that you cannot attack other countries unless you yourself are attacked. And you can't even be belligerent. You can't even threaten to attack other countries. And so what we have done is committed, a huge war crime and violated our own treaties, and nothing has happened to these people. I mean,
right.
it's just
there's a lot of rhetoric about defense, because I think the people up top know that you can only do this when you're under attack, and so the definition of defending yourself becomes distorted. Like the current attacks of Israel on Gaza, those, you know, America has said, or Obama has said, Israel has the right to defend itself, but against what? Was it defending itself against kidnapping of three young boys or three teenagers that might have not had anything to do with terrorism? I don't understand what defending yourself means in those circumstances.
And what they say is that the people who carried out the kidnapping and murder, I don't know that this is true, but what they say is it was the Al-Qaeda affiliate. Well, that's in Syria. You know, that's
right.
that's in another country. It's not in Gaza.
Right.
It's just, but that's the situation we've gotten ourselves into, and it's what the Nazis did. I mean, frankly, they fomented a tremendous fear among their population, and that justified military aggression all over Europe.
Right.
And so, you know, it's a common thing. I mean, we prosecuted the Nazis for this. We declared the Nazi Party a criminal organization, like a mafia. And we
right.
and we declared everybody who had been a member of that organization up to who had joined before 1939. They were declared to be criminals, and they were prohibited from holding office and a number of other things.
Right.
So, we know governments do this, but we have this idea that American government doesn't. You know, we know the Russians do it. we know the Germans did it. We
right.
We have no problem seeing it in other people, but we have this exceptionalism that Americans think
right,
that they're
right.
different.
One of the things you said in your paper, and I must confess I'm not an American, I'm a Canadian, so my grasp on American history is not as good as it should be, but you said that America was founded on, well, I'm seriously paraphrasing you, but you basically said America was founded on conspiracy theories, and can you...
Right.
What I mean by that?
Well, if you read the Declaration of Independence, which was the country's founding document,
mm-hmm.
it starts out by saying that there are these inalienable rights and that everybody has access to those rights, and if a government doesn't protect those, you have the right to overthrow it. But then the bulk of the Declaration of Independence is talking about the actions of King George and saying that those actions, events, or suggest there is a plot to deprive the American colonists of their rights as British citizens.
And can I stop there? So a plot is a conspiracy, because a plot is secret discussions by a group of people to do something bad. So that is a classic conspiracy, right?
Right. Yeah, they essentially were saying the British were, and they had reasons for this, but what the Declaration says is they have the right to overthrow or establish a new government, not because of any one particular thing that the king has done with his ministers, but because of the evidence from all the events combined that point to this conspiracy.
Right, so they were saying that what they're planning to do is worse than what they've already done, and we have to start a new country because of what they're planning.
Exactly. And that's the way tyranny comes about. Yeah, tyranny is not where the government comes in and just suddenly establishes a tyranny. I mean, the Nazis didn't do that. What you have instead is a series of small abuses that gradually get people to accept the violation of rights. You know, there's this famous poem about the Nazis came for the communists, and I didn't say anything, and then the Nazis came for the Catholics and so on, and now they came for me, and nobody was there to say anything. And that's how tyranny, and that's how the colonists were thinking about it, that, you know, what the king was doing was, well, I'll give you an example, just a specific case that's mentioned in the Declaration. The British had sent troops in and fought the French and Indian War. And we had American soldiers, you know, the colonists fighting, but you also had the professional British military. And what the king did after that is he said, well, now I want you to pay me back because we sent our soldiers to the colonies. And they imposed a tax on a tea and a stamp tax, that any document you had to buy this stamp and put on it to make it official. So the colonists said, I mean, what are you doing? You're making us pay a tax for defending us when we're British citizens? So it wasn't like they were, you know, making stuff up. They had real reasons for this, but it wasn't, they were not saying we're going to overthrow this government because we're being taxed. They were saying, we're going to overthrow this government because it's doing all kinds of things that is slowly strangling us.
Right. I mean, I certainly understand that the British were doing a lot of bad things at that time, but what is interesting, what you said, is that there was also a belief in a lot of conspiracies, and some of them were probably true, and some were not.
Some were not.
Exaggerated.
Right.
But now we're in a situation like if we take modern events like the assassination of the two Kennedys or 9/11, where, you know, as soon as you say there's some questions about these things, and I'm an expert in neither of them, as soon as you say there's some questions that seem legitimate, it's like, well, that's a conspiracy theory, and people look shocked and don't want to talk about it.
That's right. Well, another thing that's going on with this conspiracy theory concept, and remember, the CIA popularized that in reaction to the Warren Commission and the public doubts about it. But the conspiracy theory concept leads you to look at each event in isolation. A conspiracy is a one of. You know, if you have a series of conspiracies, you're talking organized crime.
Right.
But so when you say the Kennedy assassination was a conspiracy, what you're looking at is President Kennedy's assassination. You're not looking at President Kennedy's and Bobby Kennedy's and Martin Luther King's.
Right.
If you look at 9/11 is a good example. We should call that 9/11 anthrax, because there was the anthrax letter attacks that began a week after 9/11. Now, we learned later that the anthrax came from the U.S. military. It came from a strain of anthrax developed in Fort Meade. And so, you know, what we should have done is said, well, God, if that was an inside job of some sort, maybe this 9/11 was too. And we, one of the things I, my studies, when I've studied these high crimes, is they occur in clusters. I mean, these people that are doing this, you know, if you had the ability to assassinate a president, you think you're not going to do it again?
Well,
you know, if you can do it and get away with it.
I think one of the reasons why people are suspicious of conspiracy theories is it seems crazy, for example, for the, you know, somebody within the U.S. government to want to get rid of the president who represents the U.S. government. I mean, what are the, it's like people don't understand the reasons why somebody would want Kennedy assassinated. I mean, are there good reasons why somebody would want
to? Oh, there were. John Kennedy was a marked man. He knew he was. He was well aware of it. He had encouraged, there was a book written shortly before his assassination called 7 Days in May, and it was about a military coup. And Kennedy allowed the authors of the book, and there was a movie made after it, and he went to Camp David with his family so they could make the movie at the White House. He took it really seriously. There's a theory that's being discussed more and more called the dual state theory, the idea that there really is not just one single monolithic government with a more or less unified will, but instead that there is a public government and then there is a national security state.
Mm-hmm.
And the national security state manipulates the public state. And it has, you know, its own interests, which are mainly to foment war and maintain belligerence. I think the military leaders think that this, they think democracies are slow to respond to a gathering threat, that the appeasement policy in World War II, leading up to World War II, just showed that democracies could not face up to authoritarian threats, and so they provoke us into being afraid of these things, and they.
Well,
they
war is very profitable, and the way I look at it is that as people who like to foment war are benefiting dramatically from
absolutely,
absolutely,
and yeah, and their advancement in the military goes up. But you asked about the John Kennedy and why they would have wanted to kill him. But for one thing, he had backed off the Bay of Pigs invasion. This was an invasion of American soldiers. Of Cuban expatriates that had been trained by America, and we were making it look like they were invading Cuba, and we were going to have them establish a beachhead, and then we were going to recognize them as the lawful government of Cuba, and then we were going to send in our own troops
to protect the government. Yes.
Yeah, and he and Kennedy, they sent one group of airplanes in to shoot to destroy the Cuban Air Force, but they didn't finish off all the planes, so Castro sent his Air Force against the invaders and trapped them on the beach and killed most of them. And the number two guy in the CIA, Cabell was his name, called President Kennedy and said, "We've got to have this air power." They had done a psychological profile of Kennedy and thought that he would cave in under pressure like that.
Right.
But he wouldn't. He said, "No, I'm not going to do it. We could start a nuclear war." And so they were very angry about that. And then we had the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And the military wanted a first strike nuclear attack on the Soviet Union. Their view was that we had an advantage that would allow us to basically wipe out the Soviet nuclear threat. There would be some left over that they could retaliate with, but not much. And so they wanted to, you know, their view was, let's attack them now while we still can beat them before
To give people context, like the missile crisis was that the Russians were building missile launch facilities in Cuba.
Yes.
Right? And I mean, obviously, you can see that as a pretty direct threat to the United States.
Yes.
Would not be tolerated. But what you're saying is that you could approach it as through negotiations, through various threats, or you could start dropping nukes on Moscow.
Right, and they wanted to just nuke the Soviets. It was negotiated out. Kennedy, through back channels, not through his own State Department, went to the Soviets and said, we will pull the nuclear missiles out of Turkey if you will take the missiles out of Cuba.
Ah, okay, quid pro quo.
Yeah, and that was what the agreement was. But the U.S. military, they were suspicious. They said there was no way that they could check that the missiles had been taken out, and they were furious about this. So this happens in, you have the Bay of Pigs, in 1961, immediately after Kennedy takes office, literally within 3 months. And then a year later, you have the Cuban Missile Crisis, when the military looked at Kennedy and thought that he blinked, was
right.
The notion then that he had, you know, he was standing toe-to-toe with these guys and caved. And that, understand, from the theory at the time was that without a sure assurance that you would retaliate, that you would incur and encourage an attack on yourself. We had this thing where we kept, and still do, keep missiles in the air, nuclear bombs in airplanes flying at all times, the strategic
right,
air.
So that even if all the land
so even if all are wiped out, we'll still drop nukes on you. So that is to keep them afraid of attacking us. So this notion that Kennedy blinked was not just that he had, you know, failed to stand up in a single moment of crisis, but that he was actually putting the nation at enormous risk of nuclear attack by the Soviets. So that's 62. 63, Kennedy signs a treaty with the Soviets not to test nuclear weapons anymore in the atmosphere. And the military greatly opposed it. They said that the Russians would test their bombs on the dark side of the moon. I mean, that's really what they said, what they believed. So they thought Kennedy had bargained away American security. He was a direct threat to the survival of the nation. Now, you might say, well, you know, I mean, they knew he was doing it. Kennedy was doing drugs in the White House. He was having sexual affairs with a mafia girlfriend. And he was a pretty reckless character. Why not impeach him? Well, the reason was the impeachment would take years,
right.
Or at least a year, and it would expose all these terrible things. It would expose
right.
Kennedy's character problems, and it would have just been a nightmare. After Kennedy's assassination, one of the things I look at, I tell people, don't just look at the event. Look at what they do after the event, after these state crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And with the Kennedy assassination, 2 years after the event, they amended the U.S. Constitution to allow the Vice President of the United States, with the signatures of half of the major departments, the cabinet departments, to remove the president from office and become the acting president. The Vice President becomes the acting president. Then the president who's been removed can appeal the decision, but has there's like 30 days that this can drag out. And
right.
What's effectively happened is the vice president now has control of the military and mm-hmm. all the secrets, all the White House files and all that. So what they did was set it up so if this situation ever happened again, they could remove a president, put in the vice president, and they could do it lawfully without a long, dragged-out process that would expose the secrets of the nation.
I mean, we saw with George W. Bush where you had what appeared to be a very weak and unknowledgeable president and a very strong, dark vice president in Dick Cheney.
Yes.
I mean, I guess they didn't need to remove Bush.
But in the Kennedy case, Kennedy had picked Lyndon Johnson to be his vice president. He didn't like him. He didn't want him.
Right.
Johnson was from Texas, and you need the South to win the presidency. It's basically the Northeast votes Democrat. The West tends to vote Republican, so the South is the swing vote.
Right.
And they were beginning to vote Republican because of the Civil Rights Act and things like that. And so Kennedy needed these people, and so he put Johnson in, but then he didn't use Johnson. Now, Johnson was being investigated for taking kickbacks from a guy named Bobby Baker, who was in the government and was a wheeler dealer, like Abramoff. After the assassination, Johnson actually admitted that he had accepted an expensive phonograph, and then they dropped it at that. Because, the Congress was not going to impeach a president after they had had one assassinated and the nation was in mourning and all that. So, I call it assassination insurance. If you're a president and you pick a vice president who's a hawk and you're a dove, you have just signed your own death warrant. Reagan, who was essentially an isolationist, had picked George W. Bush as his vice president, and George H. W. Bush had been head of the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
And Reagan is shot within 3 months of taking office. One of my theories, I say this jokingly, but I'm partly serious about it, is you can see the Bushes have been careful to pick people who either wouldn't make a difference or you don't want to be president. Think about Dan Quayle for George H.W. Bush. This guy was notoriously incompetent.
Right.
And so, it's like I say, assassination insurance. But these elites know all this stuff. They're very careful about not talking publicly about it. They've got to have doubts about 9/11 and certainly the anthrax letter attacks.
Let's just take a time out here and let's talk about your term and why you prefer to use it. State crimes against democracy.
So okay.
What's the difference between state crimes against democracy that we've talked about for a little while now and conspiracy theory?
Well, a conspiracy theory, that term is being used to label, to prevent us from talking about something. And that something is suspicion of state political criminality or elite political criminality. So, first of all, we have to name the thing that we're being silenced about. And so the state crimes against democracy term is intended to do that. High crime is what the founders called it.
Mm-hmm.
But the state crimes against democracy gives it a little more meaning and is more specific. Another thing that you're doing by naming it is you're allowing it to be studied as a phenomenon, a general phenomenon. Think of how we study white-collar crime and organized crime and serial murder. We name these things, and then we develop understanding about them as a general thing, and we look for patterns, and it helps us prevent them in the future by protecting against them, and it helps us investigate them and understand them when they occur. That's what the state crimes against democracy term does. It designates a criminological phenomenon that is well recognized but has not been studied in general. So we have what we've done with conspiracy theories, we have great investigations of each isolated event. So we can tell you a lot about President Kennedy's assassination, Robert Kennedy's assassination, Martin Luther King's assassination, the attack on Ronald Reagan, George Wallace's attempted assassination.
Right.
We can tell you about misleading us into war with the Gulf of Tonkin resolution and the so-called weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. We can tell you about each of those isolated events, but what we can't tell you about is the events in general and what they are, when they occur, who's behind them,
right,
who benefits from them. The amazing thing to me, I grew up in the 60s. I was in the seventh grade when President Kennedy was assassinated. I saw on live television Oswald, Lee Harvey Oswald, shot in the Dallas Police Department.
Mm.
Now, all of this with the Kennedy thing, you know, this is a remarkable thing that you have the alleged assassin is arrested, interrogated for 2 days. Nobody takes notes. Nobody makes a recording. And then the alleged assassin is shot in police headquarters while in police custody. Now, that doesn't make you suspicious. You're an idiot.
Not at all.
But, you know, I grew up in the 60s, and there was suspicion about the President Kennedy's assassination. There was suspicion about Bobby Kennedy's assassination. There was suspicion about Martin Luther King's. But nobody said, wait a minute, are these serial crimes?
Right. I mean, they all seem to be pointing in the same
direction.
Moving
us to war.
Yeah.
Well, basically, you know, another way to look at it is anybody that ran against Nixon was liable to be murdered. So George Wallace. See, Wallace was running in 72, and Nixon was concerned about Wallace picking off the South. He had gotten five Southern states in 68. They thought he was going to get seven states in 72, and so you could have that cannibalized the Republican vote and the Democrat could win. This happened in 1992 when Bill Clinton defeated George H.W. Bush with 34% of the vote because you had Ross Perot took his vote. You know, unless you're a real insider, you don't understand that George Wallace posed this major threat to Nixon. But he did.
Well, I was going to say, because George Wallace seems to be the kind of guy that the national security state would like, and yet, in this case, he was threatening the Republican establishment. So.
That's right.
Oh.
So what this term does is it allows you to start looking at these events as a general phenomenon, and you can identify criminological circumstances and, you know, likely scenarios, timing of it. Whenever there's a presidential election, you should be on the lookout for these things because they tend to occur around them. I mean, we've invested.
You talked about October surprises in 1968 and 1980, and I was not familiar with this. Like, what do you mean by that?
All right, what this is an effort to manipulate foreign policy to alter the outcome of a presidential election in October, right before the election occurs in the first week in November. In 1968. Richard Nixon was concerned that the United States was going to make peace with North Vietnam. and that the South Vietnamese would agree to it. And Nixon sent a friend of his to talk to the president of South Vietnam and say, don't participate in the peace talks. We will get you a better deal. And so the South Vietnamese withdrew from the peace talks. If they had made peace, Hubert Humphrey, who was running as the Democratic candidate, would have been a hero, and they would have easily swept into office. So by undermining this, it made it possible for Nixon to get elected. That was treason. Say
right.
Again?
Yeah, and in 1980, this was the Iran hostage crisis, right?
The Iran, which we have very good evidence for. Let me say, on the 68 October surprise, we have excellent evidence for that as well. There's a telephone call with Lyndon Johnson, who was president at the time, with Everett Dirksen, who was a Republican leader in the Senate. And Johnson, we have this as recorded, Johnson is talking to Dirksen and says, Nixon has undermined the peace talks. This is treason. You've got to get him to stop. But I'm not going to say anything publicly about it because it would destroy the American people's faith in their leaders and government. Now, what that shows you is that you have an elite system of norms and values that one of the key rules is don't speak about these events. Don't speak about the kinds of intrigue that go on in American politics, because if the people knew it, they would not trust the government, and it would weaken its ability to deal with all kinds of things.
Right. And in 1980, like if I remember correctly, the hostage crisis was resolved after Reagan won the election and Carter.
Yeah, they met with the Iranians and said, the Republicans did, said, if you will keep the hostages till after the election, we will sell you the military parts you need for your equipment, which was American because we had supported the Shah of Iran and given him a bunch of, and the Iranians were in a war with Iraq, and so they needed these parts, and we said, you know, Reagan said, his people, it was Bill Casey, who was his campaign manager, and George H.W. Bush, who was his running mate. They met with the Iranians. Yeah, they met with their, hey, get this. Bill Casey, think about this. Bill Casey was the campaign manager for Reagan, and they made him head of the CIA. I mean, you know, if that doesn't tell you that you're dealing with some major league intrigue going on. But the other thing was the hostages were released the day of the inauguration. They were released immediately upon the inauguration. And so the American public should have thought, geez, what in the heck is going on here?
Yeah, a little timed.
Yeah, I think that these things are obvious. I think once you take the scales off your eyes and look at these, you know, objectively and not romantically, not thinking America is this perfect country and everything, and just think about it, that you've got enormous money at stake.
Right. And in 1968, why did they want to get rid of LBJ? Because that was the consequence.
They didn't want to get rid of LBJ. LBJ was not going to win because people were suspecting him of the Kennedy assassination. This is in, there's a CIA memo that popularizes it. It tells all the CIA stations around the world to talk to their media contacts and tell them, you know, there's no evidence for this conspiracy, and anybody who's talking conspiracy is a communist dupe and is, you know, trying to get famous and make money and all that. And so, but this memo starts out by saying that Johnson is the key suspect, that people view him as the likely person behind the assassination because he benefited from it. I mean, again, you know, just logic. Any other crime, you know, you got a guy who marries a rich woman and she falls in the bathtub and dies.
Right.
You'd be suspicious. It's an improbable event. Right. And then, you know, he marries again another wife, and she falls off the roof and dies. I mean,
right.
You would be like, wait a minute. And so what you've got going on in America, in American politics, is all these events that point to intrigue and are very obvious, really, once you think about them. People just don't see because they're looking at the events one at a time. They're dismissing any suspicion as harebrained and paranoid. And
one of the things you mentioned, which I thought was an interesting observation, is that the offices that get assassinated are not evenly distributed. Like, presidents get assassinated, but vice presidents don't. And what's the
never difference? Vice president, and since World War II, not a senator. We had that House member, Giffords, was the first House member shot. But, you know, I don't want to encourage anything, but, you know, the Supreme Court is probably a much more powerful official than any member of Congress, and second only to the president. And these guys don't get killed. So you got to wonder, what is going on? Well, what's going on is there's an office that has control of foreign policy, that has control of military action and covert operations, and that office is frequently targeted.
The presidency.
The president.
I mean, all it takes to ruin some plans is, like, for example, if we go to a slightly different area, but go to the question of health care, what if Obama had said, you know, what we really want in America is publicly funded universal health care.
Social security for everybody. Yeah, that would have, to be perfectly clear about it, it doesn't matter who is president of the United States. Because Obama's got enough sense to know if he did something radical, he would not last long.
Right, my point is I understand that, you know, what Obama does as president and what he said before he was president are two, like, wildly different things. But if he was to make that statement, and nobody could really stop him, he's standing up at the podium, he makes the statement, it's too late now to stop him. If he made that statement, the power of the presidency is it would totally change the debate. All of a sudden,
absolutely. And understand this. Understand that the reason people are assassinated is because there is such a thing as charisma, and you don't create it. It is born.
And right, and the Kennedys had that in spades.
And the Kennedys had it. The Kennedys had it. Martin Luther King had it.
Right.
President Obama had it. He didn't have the courage of his convictions once he got elected. But if he had spoken out, he certainly would have altered the debate. And that's why people are assassinated, because there is charisma. You get rid of the Kennedys and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, and you effectively wiped out the left in American politics for a generation.
These people tend to, they are so well-spoken. I mean, they generally look good, they're very smart, and they can put in words, they can put in simple and elegant words a new concept.
That's right.
Eliminate them, it's hard to replace it. The people who replace, they're not as good-looking, they're not as...
And they haven't built up the public following, and I mean, think about it, nobody replaced Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
I mean, once he was gone, he was gone.
Yeah, it's a big hole in the movement. And I mean, it gets refilled, but it takes 10 or 20 years to get back.
Right. See, that's why we assassinate people overseas. We don't do it just, I mean, because if they just got replaced and you had the same policy, why do it? What happens is you eliminate a leader, and there is no replacement. You get another.
Well, yeah, like in Venezuela. I mean, obviously Chavez.
Yes, exactly.
But he died. And
was an attempt to assassinate him, it looks like, and he may have been given cancer in some way. I wouldn't put this past we're very competent Secret Service
but the fact is that he died, and regardless of how, you know, whether it was stimulated or whether it's just an accident in nature, his replacement is not as eloquent, not as fast on his foot. He's not
and
doing it.
And the movement is falling apart. I mean, it's really in jeopardy, the whole progressive movement that they had underway. So, you know, think about what America could have been like with John Kennedy as a second term, maybe his brother Bobby following in his place. Of course, this is what the Republican and the military were looking at was, good Lord, we got John Kennedy, then it's going to be Bobby, and heck, it could be Ted. It could be 16 years of these guys.
I wanted to talk to you about a paper by Cass Sunstein and Adrian Vermeule.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which is basically saying that the government has to find ways to squash conspiracy theories. And they're basically saying you can't do it openly. You can't, you know, you can't have Obama standing up and saying, you know, people who have questions about 9/11 are all nutcases. It has to be done a little bit more subtly than that. So what are they proposing to...
Well, they call it, what Sunstein called it was cognitive infiltration. We don't really know exactly what they mean by that, but what it sounds like is that they would go into conspiracy theory websites and, you know, make a lot of comments that were disruptive and will throw the discussion into disarray.
Mm-hmm.
They might discredit people. You know, what they do in the espionage circles is they entrap you in something. You know, one of the things is called a honey trap. You get a beautiful woman to seduce a man, and then you expose that and ruin him.
Luckily, it's really difficult for most beautiful women to seduce most men. It's a pretty easy job, I think.
Exactly. So we don't know exactly what they're doing, but the point is they called for this infiltration of our civil society. We have a form of government that's based on the idea that people... that there's a public that talks and forms opinions and sends those opinions to its government for enacting laws and taking policy stances. And what we have is the government telling the people what to tell the government to do. And, you know, it's a circular thing that's being constructed. And we know, you know, we've got Sunstein calling for this. There was some news coming out in the last few days about the military manipulating the internet and experimenting with how to change the direction of social media and how people respond to it. Google experiment. Say again, I'm sorry.
This was on Facebook, wasn't it, where they were going to experiment with removing...
Yes.
Positive news or removing negative news, and whether they could sort of modify somebody's outlook on things.
Exactly. And what we're learning is the military has been doing this in a lot of other areas. It wasn't just this isolated case. And furthermore, that case with Google had military funding. Now, this is a very big threat to American democracy.
And Sunstein is not a nobody, right?
He's a Harvard lawyer. He was head of a major agency in the
Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs.
Yes,
appointed by President Obama. So
he's an insider, and he's involved in information policy. And he is, he's written a book called Nudge. He's written about manipulation of mass behavior. And, you know, in Germany, the guy that did that was Goebbels.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what we're talking about here. These people are plotting against us to make us conform to their priorities and to label anybody who does otherwise a terrorist.
Now that we know that the NSA and their compatriots in Canada, Germany, New Zealand, wherever, Russia... I mean, basically are making a photocopy of the Internet.
Every single thing we do,
yes.
Every phone call, every keystroke on our computers, it's a...
If another Martin Luther King arises, I mean, the first thing you do is you do a query on this guy and find out has he seen a psychiatrist like Daniel Ellsberg?
Exactly.
Has he having an affair with Martin Luther King?
Yep.
Does he do drugs? You can find, a good chance you're going to find something.
Everybody does something wrong. Everybody breaks the law in some area of life. It may be, speeding, or it may be a small thing, but if you're in high office, a small thing can be a pretty big thing, too.
Yeah, even if you've talked to the wrong people, like maybe you had a friend who, a few years later turned out to be a fundamentalist Islamist, and, you were calling him in the early days, and that can be spun into, secretly your
exactly.
Islamist terrorist.
Well, and the other thing that, about the NSA, the network of surveillance, our tendency is to be thinking about the people, the dissidents and the like, and I'm certain they're targets. But so is the Supreme Court. So is Congress. So are the executive agencies. So is the military. Look at Patriots. I mean, he was head of the CIA. And he had the girlfriend who had threatened another woman who she saw as a competitor to her liaison with Patriots. The FBI investigated and brought it out into the public, and he had
right.
to resign. I mean, in high office, there is intrigue. It's just the nature of the beast. So you give these people surveillance powers, and you know it's going to be twisted and misused.
Against you. So what can I always like to end on a sort of more positive note.
Okay.
A minute. Yeah. But, what is the average person, whether you're an American, I don't think America's unique. I mean, it's the most powerful country in the world, so things that happen in America have more weight because of that. But I think these things go on in a lot of countries. But how does the average citizen who maybe has an interest in the environment or peace or something that might go against some major interest, like how do you use this information to make more progress in the area?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. One is with the language. Don't be on the lookout for people using language in a way that frames something that is to your disadvantage. Part of what I was trying to do with the state crimes against democracy was undermine the concept of conspiracy theory.
Right.
Push it aside. But the government spends a lot of time thinking up words
right.
and deploying those. I mean, you remember when Rice and George W. Bush said they didn't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud? I mean, that was artful. I mean, that was powerful language. Well, these people are not smart enough to come up with that language.
I was actually listening to George W. Bush said something in a speech, and I thought what he just said is the most incredibly elegant and well crafted thing. Like that was written by somebody.
Oh, absolutely. they clearly have PR people doing this, and they do. They were going to call the invasion of Iraq Operation Iraqi Liberation, and that was the acronym would have been OIL. they changed it to Operation Iraqi Freedom or something. They are constantly crafting this language, and now we know they're manipulating us on the internet and tracking us and the fact that they're observing us changes us. It makes us look over our shoulders. It makes us be careful.
Yes, I think on the internet, like I'm sure that there's a lot of work into creating fake people.
Oh yeah.
I mean, I think there are people paid to go onto the internet and to sow dissension under different groups. But I think, I've got a computer science background, and if I was trying to manipulate things, I would want a computer program that could act like somebody trying to destabilize a conversation.
That's what they do. They do things on an industrial scale.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the power. I mean, when the Watergate burglars broke in, they had three people in the hotel room across the street watching. They had walkie-talkies. They had a one person that dealt with the locks. They had a separate photographer to photograph the files and stuff. So, you know, it's not like a normal break-in would be one or two people. This is a big operation. And that's what they would do on the Internet. They would automate. They would do it in big numbers.
But in Watergate, they got caught. And what was that break-in at the FBI offices that discovered information about the FBI spying on, peace activists?
On the anti-war movement and all that. That was exposing these things.
Right, that was a successful, my point is, that was a successful break-in by amateurs.
That's
and
right.
All the professionals in the world screwed up royally. So there is hope that if you believe in something and you're careful, you can move it. I'm not saying people but you can move forward.
Through advocacy and language and protest, it makes a huge difference. That's why they're trying to manage protests so closely, you know, with these free speech zones and stuff like that is because it is able to change a government. It can bring a government down. Put a million people in the streets, and the government will collapse. So there's, you know, enormous possibilities. But understand that a raid against us are vast resources that we have to be on the alert for.
Yes, I think if nothing else, I understood American foreign policy when I realized that everything that's done for American foreign policy sells more weapons. And if you think of selling weapons as the motivating factor, then all of a sudden this incredibly incompetent foreign policy suddenly becomes incredibly competent because it sells more weapons.
And, you know, the guy who was the head of the armed forces in Europe in World War II, Dwight Eisenhower, warned us on the way out that this was happening. You know, I mean, the general is telling us, hey, guys, these people are taking over.
Because I think a lot of people in the U.S. military, in any military, you know, join because they're patriotic, they want to defend their country, and then when they get involved, they realize, oh, this is not what it's about.
Yes,
things
that's exactly
are going
right.
on, they're telling me that different things are happening. I had one question when you were talking about JFK a while ago. Is the movie Dr. Strangelove a pretty accurate representation of what was going on during those crises?
It's a parody, but
right.
Dr. Strangelove was German. He was a Nazi in the movie, and at the end of the movie, you know, he can barely contain himself. He's so excited about advising. He does the Nazi salute to the president and says, "My Führer," and stuff like that. What was true about that is we had allowed the Nazis to come to work for us. And that they had developed a theory that is now very popular in the university system in the United States and elsewhere called rational choice theory that is about game theory, and we had this mutually assured destruction. And these people were, you know, they had no sentimentality. They thought in terms of, well, you're going to lose 100 million people here, 100 million people there, but it's all, you know, in the end we're going to win.
Right, and yet if their dog dies, they'd cry.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
What I was thinking of in that movie was the anxious, the military that really wanted to drop bombs.
Yes.
You know, they really wanted to see some of their nukes go off. They wanted to see a mushroom cloud. These were their toys, and they didn't like the fact that they couldn't use their toys.
Watch the movie Patton. Because in that movie, Patton says, "I just love this." You know, he's got these tank battles and stuff, and he says, "You know, God forgive me, I just love this." And you know, the military's trained to fight wars; they spend their whole life preparing for it. If they don't fight wars, you know, it's sort of like a wasted life from their point of view.
And yet, the result is, you know, I mean, from a distance, you see a tank battle as a game, but when you're up close, you see people being blown apart and
just
coming home, broken people, you know, with
exactly.
all the problems that we call PTSD.
Yep.
Anyway, the music is telling me that we've reached the end of another show, and this was a great conversation, and I appreciate you joining me today. Thank you so much.